All right, good morning, everyone. So if we could squish in, if you have extra spaces, it'd be great if everybody over there that's standing up could come in and find a seat. We could all just kind of be united, be together. That would be wonderful. Also, if you were not here last night and you did not get one of these, raise your hand and someone's going to try to get that to you. If you didn't get one of these, raise your hand. These are the notes that go along with my talks. All right, let's rock and roll. So, I think the Bible is an amazing book, but it's only amazing if it's true. I don't want to believe things just because they give me warm fuzzies. I want to believe what's true, and archaeology is one of the things that helps lend evidence to the Bible. I tend to be a little bit of a skeptical person. For example, if you were to say to me that at one time the mountains in El Paso were completely covered by water, I might not be too sure about that. Like, I don't know. But when I go out and I go hiking and I find pieces of coral and I find very clear seashell fossils and other sea creatures that have been fossilized, I look at that and I think one of two things must be true. The water must have been much higher. The mountains must have been much lower, or possibly a combination of those two things. Now, that doesn't necessarily prove Noah's Ark, but it does show that the mountains were once underwater. In the same way, when we look at archaeology, it doesn't prove everything about the Bible is true. But what it does is it lends evidence to show that the people and the places and the events described in the Bible are accurate, and that helps us to believe the bigger picture of the message of the Bible. So I'm going to look at some of the different evidences from archaeology. And the first is that there are some parallel or similar historical accounts. And that's what you would expect if the account in the Bible is true. You would expect that to carry through other cultures and people groups, that they would have similar accounts in their histories. Let me show you just a few of those. So there's a Babylonian creation myth, which starts with primeval chaos, and then it has the beginning of light, and then the light-giving objects, like the sun and the stars, which I think is kind of interesting. Then we have the creation of man. There's also an Assyrian account called the creation epic, which talks about 6 days of creation and then one day of rest. There's something called the Gilgamesh epic, which talks about a man who made a giant boat and brought his family onto it, as well as the seed of all living things. When it finally landed, he sent out a dove, a swallow, and a raven. And then he offered sacrifices to his gods at the end of that time. There were 32 different flood accounts. 30 of them have some alignment with the accounts given in the Bible. There's a monument that they found, a ziggurat, which is just basically a small tower. And it talks about, it's a monument to the building of some big, amazing tower. And they also found this clay tablet in the same area. And the clay tablet describes this tower and how when they made this tower, the gods got angry and they destroyed the tower and scattered the people and scattered their languages. I thought that was kind of interesting. Sounds a lot like the Tower of Babel. We also have biblical accounts that skeptics would say, oh, King David, he never existed. He's only in the Bible. We don't find him in archaeology anywhere. Pilate, he never existed. That's just something that the Bible made up. And yet, over time, again and again, we find that the Bible proves these things that once people thought weren't true. So we have evidence for David, evidence for Abraham and Lot, and for the Hittites. They thought they never existed, and then they found 1,000 clay tablets, including this little gold statue, which clearly shows that the Hittites invented the sombrero. We have evidence for Solomon and his chariot cities. We have evidence for the census that was taken in the time of Jesus. They said, there's no way they wouldn't make people go back to their hometown for a census. Who does that? Well, they found another census, a different one, and that's exactly what they made them do. They found evidence for Pontius Pilate. And then we have countless miscellaneous archaeological evidence over all kinds of different things that line up to the Bible throughout Scripture. We have evidence for Jacob's well. They still know where that's at. This one's pretty cool. They found this prism that has the account of Sennacherib coming up against Hezekiah, which is in the Bible, but this is the account from the perspective of the Assyrians, which is kind of a fascinating thing. We have evidence of the Moabites. In this little monument, they have, it talks about Jehu, son of Omri, who's one of the Israelite kings, and it has a picture of him bowing down to a king of Assyria. We have evidence for the Pool of Siloam in Jerusalem, including inside one of the tunnels, there's an inscription that tells about how it was built, and that matches the biblical account. We have evidence for Herod. As we get to the later New Testament, there's all kinds of evidence, just tons and tons of archaeological finds. And in Lystra, we have the Temple of Zeus. In Athens, we have Mars Hill. We have an inscription to an unknown god, or an inscription, it says, sacred whether it be to a god or goddess, which sounds a lot like the inscription to an unknown god that Paul talked about. Evidence from Corinth, and I like this one, the Erastus paving stone, which is proof of this guy's existence. It's just a guy that's mentioned in passing in the Bible. Ephesus, the Temple of Artemis, in the theater in Ephesus. And so there's a lot of different archaeological evidence. We don't need proof of everything. We need enough proof to say, I am so confident in the truth of the Bible that I am willing to put my faith in the message of the Bible, that we're sinners, that Jesus came to save sinners, and that we can have eternal life by putting our faith in him. And I've banked my life on the truth of the Bible because of archaeological evidence and evidence from prophecies, evidence from history. There's a lot of different types of evidence, and those all help me to say, yes, I'll bank my life on this.
I don't know how much I'm going to remember from this conference, but I'm going to remember a pregnant goldfish. All right, well, I should probably start out with the introduction. And again, my name is Aaron, and I'll give you the obligatory family photo. So here's my family. I am married to Christy, and looking at that picture, she's not actually that short. But I've been married to Christy for about 17 years, and we have 4 kids. Our oldest is Caleb. He's here. He's going to be a freshman this coming year. And then we've got Micah, 12, Daniel, 10, and Abby is 6, and they are definitely my delight. Like I said, we've been married for about 17 years and have these 4 children. I've been a pastor in Fort Collins for about 10 years, and before that, I worked as an engineer. I was a civil engineer for about 5 years. Before that, I went to college at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, and it was there that I met Jesus. And I came to a faith in him. Prior to that, I had this sort of fuzzy belief in God, but it wasn't really defined. But I came to know Jesus there as a sophomore in college. And there was a lot that led me there. I think this is how the Holy Spirit works. The Holy Spirit draws us and shapes us and helps us to believe. But God uses a lot of different things, a lot of different factors to draw us to himself. And so there were a handful of those things with me. One, the love of the church. And I came into this community here in Summit View Church, and I experienced love and friendship and self-sacrificing friendship like I don't think I had before. And it was compelling for me. There was something that love of the church did in my heart that softened me and opened me to the gospel. Another thing that I think influenced me towards Jesus was in this same loving community, I saw purposefulness. Okay, purposefulness. And that was compelling for me because I was kind of drifting through life at that point, and I wasn't sure really what mattered or if anything mattered. And when I saw a group of people who were living for something, and living for something meaningful and lasting, that also was compelling for my soul. Another thing that I think was a big factor in my coming to Christ is what we're talking about this week. When I got involved with this community, people started asking me questions. They started showing me different things. They started challenging me. And I became convinced of the truth of it. Up until that point, I didn't think you could really know with any kind of certainty. Again, I had this maybe fuzzy belief in God, But it was sort of wishful thinking, and it was kind of just the safe thing to do. I thought, well, it's probably safer to believe in God to not. But there's not a lot of really valid reason to believe in all this. That's what I thought. But I was shown otherwise. And people opened my eyes, and they gave me things to read, and they described different arguments for me, and I came to believe that this is true. It's true, and you can believe it, you can trust it. It's not just wishful thinking, it's not this blind leap of faith, but it's actually true. And that was really important for me as well. And so I'm excited that we're covering a lot of what we're covering this week, because I think it is really important. And it creates a backbone in our faith and a resiliency. And so I'm excited for that. And I'm excited not just to have us all learn some facts about God and not just to be drawn into a deeper belief in his existence, but I'm hoping that we can not only understand that he's there, but that he's near. Like he's right here. I think so much of the power of apologetics is convincing our hearts that God is close and he's personal. And so I hope as we share these evidences and these truths that we're drawn close and we're drawn into wonder and awe about who God is. Okay, so my goal this morning, what I get to tackle, is maybe the most foundational question. And that is, does God exist? Is God even there? That's what we're going to start out with. And of course, we're going to build on that in the next couple days, but we're going to start out with, can we even believe that there is a God? And of course, I'm going to make the case that yes, we can believe that. And not only is he there, but he is obviously there. I want to share Romans 1, 18 through 21. We'll read this together. It says, "For God's wrath is revealed from heaven against all godlessness and unrighteousness of people who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. Since what can be known about God is evident among them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, that is his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen since the creation of the world, being understood through what he has made. As a result, people are without excuse. For though they knew God, they did not glorify him as God or show gratitude. Instead, their thinking became worthless and their senseless hearts were darkened." This is a strong passage. And it says that God is obvious. He is evident. It's clearly seen. Not only his existence, but even his nature. Clearly seen from what has been made. You can observe the world around you since the beginning of time and clearly see God. That's the case that the Bible makes here. So much so that we are without excuse. If we reject God, we are without excuse and even deserve his wrath, is what it says. That's a strong passage. Now, of course, a lot of people would not agree with this. And let me give you a little bit of a quote from Bertrand Russell, very prominent atheist in the first part of the 20th century. And this is a description of an interview or a conversation that a man named Leo Rostin had with him. And this is what he says. "I, Leo Rostin, asked, 'Let us suppose, sir, that after you have left this sorry veil, you actually found yourself in heaven, standing before the throne. There in all his glory sat the Lord.' 'Not Lord Russell, sir, God.' Russell winced. 'What would you think?' 'Well, I would think I was dreaming.' 'But suppose you realize you were not. Suppose that there before your very eyes, beyond a shadow of a doubt, was God. What would you say?' The pixie wrinkled his nose. 'I probably would ask, sir, why did you not give me better evidence?'" And so that's what Bertrand Russell would say to God, apparently. "You didn't give me enough evidence." Now, he's pretty convinced that God is not there, and he's convinced that there's not much reason to believe that he is. And so you see people on each side of this question, and some would align with the Bible and say, yes, he is clearly seen, absolutely evident. It's easy. And then there would be others that would be on the opposite side and say, no, it's not clear at all. If he's there, he hasn't given us much to go on. Now, how does that happen? How do different people of, say, similar intelligence, because there are smart people on each side, how do people of similar intelligence with access to the same information come up with radically different conclusions like that? Well, I think it's probably important to understand that belief, coming to belief, is a pretty complex thing. Okay, I said there were a lot of factors that led me to Jesus. Well, there are a lot of factors that shape our beliefs. And one of those would be reason. Okay, so I take in all the data, and I process it with my rationale, and I come to a conclusion. And a lot of us think, well, that's the way that we come to belief. That's kind of the only way. We use our reason, and then we land on a belief. But if we're honest, we have to admit that a lot goes into our belief, that we're not quite as objective as we think we are. So our experiences shape our belief. Okay, obviously, what we go through is going to push us in different directions. And so, say I experience some pain in the church. What if I experience abuse in the church? Well, that's going to influence me away from Christianity. Regardless of the rational reasons for it or against it, that experience is going to push me in one direction or the other. So our experiences are a huge factor. Our relationships, as Greg shared last night, we're relational beings. And so our relationships influence us a lot. And sometimes we believe in such a way that aligns us with the people that we want to be aligned with. Okay, we want favor with other people, and so we believe in a certain way. Again, it's not necessarily a reasonable, rational decision. It's a relational one. And then, of course, there are our desires. Maybe this is the big one. Sometimes we just believe what we want. We just believe what we want. I want to do what I want to do, and so I'm going to believe whatever allows me to do that. Now, there could be a lot more arrows that go into this that I could put up here, but the point is that a lot goes into shaping our beliefs. And so two very intelligent people can come up with different conclusions because different things are affecting them. I'm going to make the case, though, this morning, that if somebody denies the existence of God, it's not due to reason. I believe that God has given us ample reason to believe in himself. And if we are not seeing that, there may be a lot that's working on us outside of just our rationale. Okay? So, let's think about how God communicates to us. And I'm going to share a little bit from Psalm 19. Psalm 19 is a pretty remarkable psalm, but it speaks about how God reveals, and reveals in two different ways, actually. And the first part of the psalm, I'll just read the first couple of verses, says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the expanse proclaims the work of his hands. Day after day they pour out speech, night after night they communicate knowledge." So God communicates through the heavens. They actually pour out speech and knowledge. So from what has been made, just like Romans 1 says, from what has been made, God speaks. But then the second half of Psalm 19 speaks, or it summarizes how he speaks in more of a specific way, using words even. It says, "The instruction of the Lord is perfect, renewing one's life. The testimony of the Lord is trustworthy, making the inexperienced wise." And so God reveals just through what he has been made, and then he speaks in a special way. And what we call these two different ways of revealing is general revelation and special revelation. Those are the terms given. And so general revelation, again, from what God has made, we can observe what God has made, and we receive knowledge and communication and information from him. But then there's special revelation where God actually speaks in a special, specific way, of course, through his Bible. Now, my task this morning is to show that through general revelation, God has communicated his existence clearly. Of course, we'll get to special revelation later. Greg Miller is going to share about that later this morning even. And we need special revelation. General revelation isn't enough to get us where we need to go, and I'll share about that later too. But according to Romans 1, general revelation is powerful, and he's given it to us, and we can believe that God exists because he's shown us in his natural world. And so I'm going to give you four arguments for the existence of God from general revelation, also called natural theology. And these are four sort of classic arguments, and they can be worded in different ways, but I'll try to explain them and make them a little more clear. But let me just summarize them real quick. Here are the four arguments that I'm going to go through. We know God exists. Number one, we know God exists because the world exists. I'll explain that. Number two, we know God exists because we see creativity everywhere. Number three, we know God exists because we are conscious thinkers. Number four, we know God exists because we recognize right and wrong. Hey, now, each of these we can understand, again, by simply observing the world around us. And we can understand, everybody could have understood these things from the beginning of time. That's, again, what Romans 1 says. From the very creation, people have been able to understand from what has been made that God is there and even something about his nature. And so each of these things, they don't need some sort of, you know, special modern degree in biochemistry or physics or something like this. We can understand each of these arguments, at least to a degree, by simply observing the world around us. I would even argue that a young child throughout history has some grasp of each of these arguments, some sort of elementary, simple grasp of each of these arguments. And so actually what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at it, at each of these arguments from a couple of different directions. We're going to understand that there is a simple way to frame each one of these arguments that a young child, just by thinking about his world, can sort of get. But also, we can push each one of these arguments pretty far and go pretty deep. And the philosophy professor can write books on each one of these. And this, I think, is actually one of the remarkable things about God. On one hand, he is very accessible. He's very accessible to the young child. And so even the five-year-old has some sense of God in these ways that I'm going to describe. And yet, God is also incredibly complex. And he's satisfying to the intellectual. And so what we're going to do is we're going to frame each of these arguments in kind of this simple, childlike way, and then we're going to just touch on the more complex argument, kind of the philosophical argument. And of course, since books can be written on those, I'm not going to go too deep. I'm just going to kind of whet your appetite and say, this is an argument out there. Go search it out. And so we are going to go to get a little philosophical here. And hopefully stretch us some. And I understand we're on summer break. Okay, we're out of school. You came up here to play human foosball and that kind of thing. But stick with us here and allow yourself to be stretched. Okay, I think, you know, I said my oldest is he's going to be a freshman in high school. But I look at even some of the things that he learned in eighth grade, some of the books that he read, some of the subjects that he dealt with in school, and they're pretty weighty. And I know all of you guys in school, you get stretched. You're taking calculus and chemistry and physics and those kinds of things. You allow yourself to be stretched there at school. And don't shortchange God with your mind here. Okay, allow yourself to be stretched some too. And you may not even totally grasp these things right away, but just let them be an initial step. Even like Greg was sharing last night where he said we're all being prepared. Well, let yourself be prepared to take a little step into some of these areas and then maybe go further in the future. Okay, so we'll get pretty simple and then a little philosophical and stretch us a bit. All right, so let's go to our first argument. That the world exists. We understand that God exists because the world exists. Maybe. Let's see. There we go. So the young child is thinking, he's just observing his world, and he says, you know, it's hard to imagine all of this just happening. Someone must have started it. Okay, you may have had that thought even as a young child. I think I did too. Looked around my world and said, yeah, I think somebody's behind all this. Seems like somebody must have got the ball rolling here. That's what we think. That's actually intuitively, we're born into the world with that kind of sense. Yeah, I think somebody started all of this. You know, even the young child, the three-year-old child, is always asking why. Pestering his parents. Why is this true? Why did that happen? Why this? And just always asking why. And that shows something. That shows that that young three-year-old is taken in his world, and he understands this thing called cause and effect. That when you observe one set of circumstances, it was led to by a previous one. Okay, every effect has a cause. That's what he's realizing when he's asking why. Okay, and his parents answer those questions, and they say, well, because of this, and well, because of this, and pretty soon they get irritated and say, well, that's just how God made it. And that's the right answer. You got to get back to that eventually, that somebody started it. Some uncaused cause got it going. That's the childlike, simple understanding. And yet, we can push that pretty far. We can explore that philosophically pretty far. Let's make a formal, logical argument. Hold on, I got an alarm going off. Sorry about that. So these are what the philosophy professors do. They make an argument, and they kind of formalize it, and they break it into different steps. You guys, if maybe some of you have even probably taken a logic class, and you've learned what a syllogism is. Anybody heard of a syllogism? It's just a formal argument where there are different premises that lead up to a conclusion. And so you kind of break apart this argument, and then you lay it out, and you come to a conclusion that can be said to be logically true. So the classic one that, you know, an intro to logic or philosophy class uses is, okay, all men are mortal, premise number one. Number two, Socrates was a man. Conclusion, Socrates was a mortal. Okay, pretty simple. You can understand how that works. Well, let me give you, again, this could be a little stretching, but let me give you how people formalize the argument that little kid just made, okay, that God exists. And this kind of argument from God being the original cause of the world, it's called a cosmological argument. Okay, you can just kind of stick that in your brain. These are called cosmological arguments. And there's a handful of different ways to lay them out, but that's what they're called. And so I'm going to give you two examples. And again, I'm not going to go into depth because we'd have to read big, fat books, but I'm just going to lay them out for you and explain them just real briefly, and then understand, okay, you could go further in this. Okay, I'm going to start with the Leibnizian cosmological argument. All right? And this old guy named Gottfried Leibniz. Let me read it through. Premise number one, everything that exists has an explanation of its existence, either in the necessity of its own nature or in an external cause. All right, some of you are glazing over already, but hang here. Okay, so either in the necessity of its own nature, meaning it just kind of has to exist. Some people would say numbers are like that. So the number seven wasn't caused by an external cause. It's just a concept that sort of has to exist. So that would be the thought. So either by the necessity of its own nature or an external cause, something had to, from the outside, had to put it into motion. Premise number two, if the universe has an explanation of its existence, that explanation is God. Something outside of the universe had to cause it, and that is what we call God. Number three, the universe exists. Number four, therefore, the universe has an explanation of its existence. Therefore, five, conclusion, therefore, the explanation of the universe's existence is God. Now, again, the books are written on those first two premises. And so we're not going to go into them in depth here, but I just want you to understand that they check out. They pass the test. When you think about them, and when you go to all the places that they could take you, they check out. Okay, let me give you another version of a cosmological argument. This is called the Kalam cosmological argument, maybe a little simpler. Number one, whatever begins to exist has a cause. Something begins to exist, it was caused by something. Number two, the universe began to exist, and that's the controversial one. But even in the last century, a lot of people, most people, I would say, have come to the conclusion that the universe began to exist. It's not just eternally existing. And we can argue about the when and the how and all that. I think most people, most physicists would say, yes, the universe, they would admit that. The universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe had a cause outside of itself. And that cause must be God. Okay, so just want to throw those things out there and have us understand that childlike intuition that we have very early on that says, yeah, I think something started all this. Somebody started all this. As you push it as far as it can go, it checks out. It passes the test. And we can believe that this universe was caused by somebody outside of the universe. And we can draw implications about the nature of that person as well, which we'll get into later. But the first evidence, or the first argument for God's existence is that all of this exists, and somebody must have done it. Okay, next, argument number two. Creativity is everywhere. And again, the childlike argument, when you're really young, you observe the world around you, and you say this, well, it sure seems like the things in this world were made on purpose with a plan in mind. It's like I see beautiful art and orderliness everywhere, which makes me think there must be an artist. Again, very young, you just sort of have this sense. It's intuitive. Somebody sometimes argues against that and makes you give up that intuition. But I think we're all born with this sort of intuition. We recognize it. As we observe our world, we see beauty. We see structure. We are overwhelmed with majesty and awe. And when we experience those kinds of things, it just makes us think, somebody did this. There's an artist. There's an engineer behind this. Okay, it's just hard to imagine all this just happening. Why do I have this sense of awe, this sense of majesty? Why do I get the impression that this was made when I see this kind of structure? In fact, I could go to this quote from Richard Dawkins, maybe the most famous atheist of the last couple decades. And he writes in The Blind Watchmaker, he says, "Biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose." Now, of course, he doesn't believe that they were designed for a purpose, and he's trying to convince people against their intuition. They weren't really designed, but even he would admit, you naturally think, yeah, this was designed. That's just what I think. Right? And, you know, when we observe this world, we're up here in the mountains, and we look all around us, and we see the structure of things. And we don't have to have this advanced degree, but when we look around it and we see how things operate, it just draws out this sense in us that somebody made it. Somebody designed it. Somebody injected beauty into it. Now, we can go further than that. We can bring into the equation modern science and modern philosophy, and so let's do that really quick. And we may get into this in another message later on, but you know, we see design as we use our microscopes and as we look at the small. So, I mean, you guys know these kinds of things. The amount of information stored on a pinhead's volume of DNA, if written on paperback books, would make a pile of such books 500 times higher than from here to the moon. There is an incredible amount of information in you. Not just information, but instruction sets. Okay, there's sets of instruction. And so when we start looking down and underneath all these things, we see design. It should smack us. It should be a very intuitive, natural thing to believe as well. Or we could look up. We could look at the cosmos, and we can use our telescopes instead of our microscopes. You may have heard this argument, the argument about fine-tuning, the fine-tuning of the universe. And the idea there is that this universe operates under laws that are so fine-tuned, so precisely tuned, that if they weren't tuned with such precision, life couldn't exist. The universe as we know it couldn't exist. So I'll give you a few examples. If certain variables that govern the forces of nature were altered just slightly, a life-permitting universe would not exist. So the people that measure these types of things, they assume this. If the force of gravity was off by one part in 10 to the 50th, that a life-permitting universe could not exist. Or if the cosmological constant, and that's just a number basically that governs the expansion of the universe, and it needs to expand at a certain rate so it doesn't collapse back upon itself or it doesn't just spread out to nothingness. Well, the cosmological constant, it is said that if it was off one part in 10 to the 120th, that life couldn't exist as we know it. Also, the universe's initial entropy condition, one part in 10 to the 10th times 123. And just these numbers are incomprehensible to us, but just to put in a little bit of perspective, the total number of subatomic particles in the known universe is 10 to the 80th. So the universe is tuned with an incredible precision, just an incredible precision. And again, if you look at that and observe it, the natural reaction should be, somebody must have done that. Somebody must have designed it. And so we can make our argument. It's called the teleological argument. That's basically an argument from design. And it says the fine-tuning of the universe is due to physical necessity, chance, or design. That's how the argument is framed. One of those three. I can't think of any other reason it would be fine-tuned. But number two, it's not due to physical necessity. It just doesn't have to be like that. And it's not just chance. Therefore, it is due to design. Okay, so we know God exists because we see design and we see artistry everywhere. Third argument, we are conscious thinkers. So again, the young kid starts thinking, looks around his world, looks at himself and people around him, and he says this, well, life is amazing. Somehow the world is filled with creatures who think and make decisions. That's a wild thought, okay? That doesn't seem like it could happen without something supernatural making it possible. Okay, because we think, because we use our reason and our rationale, that says something. Okay, we need to understand that says something. Because if you think about it, what if there was no God, and what if everything just happened naturally, according to the laws of nature, the forces of nature? What if everything just happened naturally? Well, that includes me and my mind. So every thought I have, every word that I'm speaking right now, is just the end result of natural forces working on my matter. And I don't have any say in it. It's not like I chose to say these words. They were just determined for me. And that's important to understand. If naturalism is true, meaning it's just the natural world, everything is determined by those forces. Naturalism, atheism, is the most fatalistic philosophy out there. Everything's determined. And the honest atheists admit this. Let's go to a couple. This guy named Werner Rein, and he's a president of a humanist society, and he says, uses some big words here, but I think we can follow it, the determinist position that everything is determined by the laws of nature is that in a universe governed by the strictest natural laws, all events arise naturally and inevitably from causative factors that follow these laws. Hopefully you track with that. Everything is inevitable. They just track with the natural laws that push them in a certain direction. Determinism thus affirms the inevitability of the actual. It is difficult to see how this can be disproved conclusively, even in theory. And he's admitting something. Everything's determined. Everything's determined by nature. Friedrich Nietzsche would say the same. Today, we no longer have any pity for the concept of free will. We know only too well what it really is, the foulest of all theologians' artifices aimed at making mankind responsible in their sense, that is, dependent upon them. And many other famous atheists would say the same. It's all natural, including you. You can't rise above nature, meaning you can use your thinking to impose your will on nature. No, nature determines everything for you. Okay? Now, obviously there's a contradiction there. If I'm using my reason to say there's no reason, you sort of get tripped up a little bit there. C.S. Lewis called this the cardinal difficulty of naturalism. And I think he's right here. This is the big issue. This is the big contradiction. This is what makes naturalism so incoherent. He says, unless human reasoning is valid, no science can be true. If the value of our reasoning is in doubt, you cannot try to establish it by reasoning. And he goes on, a theory which explained everything else in the whole universe, but which made it impossible to believe that our thinking was valid, would be utterly out of court. And of course it would. Okay? We can't get away from the reality of our own thinking. We may try, we may say we don't believe in it, but of course we do. And it just seems like one of the most natural things that we always experience. Again, from a very young child, we think, we use our reason. And that indicates that there's a thinker, an original thinker. Okay, that there's something outside of nature. If we're gonna say that our thoughts, our reason are valid, we're saying there's something more than nature. And so here's how the argument could go. Thinking, if it is genuinely happening, is not natural. But we are thinking creatures. Therefore, there is something more than nature. And C.S. Lewis would again say that something more is God. One more quote. Yet if any thought is valid, such a reason must exist, an ultimate reason, and must be the source of my own imperfect and intermittent rationality. Human minds, then, are not the only supernatural entities that exist. We think, you can rephrase, we think, therefore God is. Okay, that's the reality there. Fourth argument, we know right and wrong. And so the young child again says this, every day I see good and bad all around me, and I feel bad when I do something wrong. I suppose someone bigger than us must have decided what's right and wrong, and that's why I feel like I need to answer to somebody when I mess up. And so I think this child, we all do, we have this sense. I think there's something right and there's something wrong. And when I do wrong, I feel it. There's something in my conscience that is telling me there's something above me. There's an objective morality rather than subjective. So objective, it's outside of myself. It's over all of us. It's not just preference. It's not just something that I make up. But there's something over me that is governing me morally. And that makes me think, hey, there's an ultimate moral lawgiver there. Now, honest atheists, again, would acknowledge that if there's no God, there's no true objective morality. So let me give you another quote from this guy named William Provine, who was a professor at Cornell University. And he's pretty blunt here. He says, when you die, you're not going to be surprised because you're going to be completely dead. Now, if I find myself aware after I'm dead, I'm going to be really surprised. But at least I'm going to go to hell where I won't have all those grinning preachers from Sunday morning listening. Let me summarize my views on what modern evolutionary biology tells us loud and clear. And these are basically Darwin's views. There are no gods, no purposes, and no goal-directed forces of any kind. There is no life after death. When I die, I am absolutely certain that I am going to be dead. That's the end of me. There is no ultimate foundation for ethics, no ultimate meaning in life, and no free will for humans either. What an unintelligible idea. So he also admits there's no free will. There's no free will if we really believe that nature is all there is. But he also adds to it and says there's no ultimate foundation for ethics. And that makes sense. If there's no God, if there's no one who from whom ethics flows, then there's no reason to believe that I am subject to any moral law. There really isn't. There's no reason for me to believe, for example, that slavery is wrong. Why would slavery be wrong? And you can say, well, because it hurts somebody, it oppresses somebody, it brings pain into somebody's life. But what if their pain enhances my happiness? What if I can subject somebody and I get more pleasure out of that? Why is their pain of greater value than my increased happiness? And I would say under naturalism, there's no reason that it is. In fact, that's kind of the law of nature. That's how it works in the animal kingdom. The strongest lion gets the harem. Okay, the animals subject each other in order to get the highest position. So if I'm able to do that, why not? I mean, my life is pretty limited anyways. I just have a few years here. I better milk it for as much as I can and use all of you in the process if I can. I mean, why wouldn't that be wrong? I don't think it would be if there's no God. It is the survival of the fittest. I've got to do everything that I can to enhance my pleasure and happiness. There's really no basis for morality outside of God. People will try to argue that there is, but I really believe there isn't. I don't think anybody's made a real credible argument there. And yet, we all believe in morality. We can't get away from it. Just like we can't get away from the validity of our own reasoning, we can't get away from morality either. Everybody says, yeah, that was right, that was wrong. We hold people to standards. Again, it's such an intuitive thing. We have to, I think, if we're being honest, acknowledge, yeah, there's true objective morality. And so the argument goes, if God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. Premise two, objective moral values and duties do exist. Three, therefore, God exists. And these arguments, they are woven into the fabric of everything that we do and all of life all around us. Cause and effect is just something that we know, and we know very early in life. This recognition of design is something that we just know, and we know very early in life. An understanding of our own thinking is something that we know very early. Morality is something that we know very, very early. And everything in life rests upon those things. God is just crying out in just the basics of our world and our lives. He's there. Now again, atheists who deny God even have trouble doing it without borrowing these concepts from theism, from Christianity even. Let me go back actually to our friend Bertrand Russell. And let me just read this, what he says. He says, I am myself a dissenter from all known religions, and I hope that every kind of religious belief will die out. I do not believe that, on the balance, religious belief has been a force for good. Although I am prepared to admit that in certain times and places it has had some good effects, I regard it as belonging to the infancy of human reason and to a stage of development which we are now outgrowing. So you'll hear statements like this quite a bit, but you look at it and you say, wait a second. He's appealing to the good, and he's appealing to reason. Two things that elsewhere he denies are even real. And this you will see this in so many critiques of Christianity. They will use some moral standard or use rationale and make the case. Christianity is irrational, unreasonable. Christianity is not good. It's immoral. But how do you know what morality is? And how is your reason valid at all? Well, they're not in naturalism. And so I think this is something to look for. At the very foundation, you got to have God. You got to have him there. And therefore, I think we can go back to Romans 1 and say it's true. Yes, from the very beginning of creation, since the creation of the world, we can look around our world, not having to have an advanced degree, But look around our world, and we see these things that make up the fabric of how everything works, everything that we know to be true. And God must be at the bottom of those things. He is evident. He has been clearly seen. We are without excuse. And one more thing, not only is he clearly seen in terms of his existence, but also his nature. Remember, it says his divine nature has been clearly seen. So we can know things about who God is from what we observe, not just that he's there. So from our four arguments, I think we can draw out these qualities of God. God is eternal. Okay, if he brought the universe, meaning he brought time and space into existence, that means he's above those things. So he's eternal and spaceless. He's obviously creative. He's intentional. He's thoughtful. And he's good. This sounds like a personal God. And we can believe in a personal God, that's his nature, simply by observing the natural world. So, going back to an early thought, if we pull out a couple other verses from Romans, I'll read them quick. It says, "For though they knew God, they did not glorify him as God or show gratitude. Instead, their thinking became worthless and their senseless hearts were darkened. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served what has been created instead of the Creator, who is praised forever. Amen." So the way Romans 1 talks about it is that we naturally recognize God, his existence and his nature, but then we exchange it. We knew God, but then we give it up. And that's what happens. And generally that happens because of our sinful desires, because of our desire to be king. Or our desire for a variety of different things, we give up that knowledge of God. But if we truly think about it, I think we can conclude, no, God is at the bottom of everything, and he's obviously, clearly there. So, from general revelation, we can look around our world, say, there's God. He's there. It's clear. He's even revealed things about his nature. Now, as I said earlier, that's not enough. We can understand quite a bit about God there, like I just described. But when we are asking questions about how he feels about us, how he's going to relate to us, we need him to tell us those things. We need him to say, this is how I feel. This is what I will do for you. We need him to, in a special, specific kind of way, using words, tell us those things. And so, of course, that's where we're going next. And we're going to talk about the truth of the Bible, because we need it. Okay, so I'm going to pray, and then I think we're going to take a break. And then Greg's going to tell us a little later this morning about the truth of the Bible. So let me pray. Well, God, I thank you so much for revealing yourself in the ways that you do. And I know sometimes the world can get in the way and our view of you can get fuzzy. But I think when we declutter and when we shed all of that baggage and we just come before you and plead with you and seek you, you're there and you're obviously there. And I just want to ask that each person in this room would be able to see that. Even over the next couple days, if any of us are struggling with just the reality of your presence, I pray that we can take some time alone. We can go sit on a rock out here somewhere and simply seek you. Because you promise when we seek you, we find. And so I pray that each person here would find you and the fullness of who you are. And I pray that in Jesus' name, amen.